Good morning, everyone, from a sunny Milan. This is Judith from the Color Authority. And today I'm going to be talking to Justine Fox, who is a consultant with a unique understanding of applied color psychology, color trend, insight, and color economics with future thinking. Her multidisciplinary perspective on color creates engagement with people through product development, social content, publications, and immersive installations. She's focusing on bringing awareness to all stakeholders within urban planning and architecture on the considered use of color to help improve sustainability, inclusivity, community, and safety for all people who live and work in a built environment. She's co-founder of Calzada Fox, a color consultancy agency, with a difference, combining strategic vision, creativity, and innovation. Welcome to the Color Authority, everyone, and welcome, Justine. I'm so happy to be talking to you today. How are you?
I'm great. Thank you, Judith. Thank you so much for having me.
So you're calling out from London, right? That's where you are in lockdown currently.
Yes, I am in sunny London for a change.
So Justine, you've been a color girl from the very start of your career when you started at Global Color Research, Mix Magazine. And then until today, you are an independent color consultant. Tell us a little bit more about your very specific choice. So why color? And then a little bit about what you did for Global Color Research, now Color Hive, and why you decided to go independent.
Yeah. Yes, well, actually, I came to colour a little bit late. I always wanted to be either a pathologist or a fashion designer. And I ended up following that path in fashion design, and I worked within that industry for a few years. And then I moved on to freelancing within some of the big agencies that look at interiors in like aviation or in banking or different areas, and they're very brand focused. It was through that process that I realized that I had a love of design. So it wasn't particularly fashion that I was focused on. It was design in general. So it was quite difficult to understand where I fit. And it was during a stint in store development for one of the big retailers that through a process of kind of consultation, I discovered that actually the key area for me was color. And so I took that kind of information. I researched about color and found somebody who was working with the same retailer actually on applied color psychology. And so I actually started my career from the applied color psychology aspect. And it was just that back in the day, there weren't really any jobs in that area. And so I fell into trend, to be honest. I wanted to get a job in color. And somebody recommended Global Color Research to me. That's how it all began. So I was with Global Color for about 7 years. I was their creative director for projects, so working with companies around the world on developing color palettes, color offerings, trend information. And then I had a baby. I didn't want to do all that traveling anymore. And so I decided to go independent. And it also gave me the opportunity to explore beyond trend. I didn't start off as a big fan of the trend industry. I grew to respect it. However, my personal feelings have also always gone towards there being more out there. And so going independent allowed me to explore more of those areas and to build personal ideology about how you work with colour and exploration. And then about 2 or 3 years ago, I met Carolina Calzada again, who I'd been working with at Global Colour Research, and we started Calzada Fox. You know, the reason for Calzada Fox has always been that it should be colour beyond aesthetic. So that's really kind of the core of the way that I look at colour.
Very interesting. I think indeed, when you talk about trends, it seems that it's not really always been your greatest passion. It's been more the colour psychology side of it. Do you find that now after that you've made that change a couple of years back when you said there were no jobs, do you feel that there is more work in this particular area right now? Has the market changed and has the request changed?
I think the recognition of different aspects of colour is starting to change. It's not there yet. The trend industry itself has been changing over the last kind of 15, 16 years that I've been working in colour. I noticed that where you started off with those great forecasters of the day who would stand up at Heim Textil and dictate, you know, this is the way that everything will go. Now, trend forecasters are opposing possibilities to people more. So there seems to be more of a kind of democratic approach now to trend forecasting. I have noticed that industries have opened up much more to the ideas of colour psychology, whereas when I started out, people thought it was something mystic, something hippie. But colour is an emerging science. You know, there's still so much that we don't know about it, and there's so much to explore still. That I think that's where I usually feel uncomfortable if people call me a colour expert, because, you know, what is an expert? I know a lot more about colour than maybe your average person. However, there is still so much to learn. And I think that's where I find this passion for colour, is we're learning new things about it all the time. And the possibilities of it are phenomenal.
I totally agree with that. I mean, we've discussed this so often during, you know, the past couple of years when we met, that there's no such thing as just colour. It's storytelling when you work in colors, but also in color trends. But I think the color exploration, indeed, you are absolutely correct. There's so many things we don't know about it yet, and so many things that we still need to explore. But when we talk about the let's say the storytelling, the narrative, which is so important when you work with color, because it's not just, you know, a red or blue, and you have to adapt that to a situation, to maybe a customer, an environment. Can you a little bit explain the audience what type of methodology you use when you work in color, and then obviously color trends?
Yeah, I mean, from the perspective of color trends, I do love a PEST analysis. So looking at political, economic, sociological, and technological in terms of understanding how the world is changing. So one of the things that helped me come to terms with trend and to understand it, coming from the applied colour psychology background, was that I started to recognise that there were relationships between what's happening in the world and what colours we were choosing to have around us. I did a bit of a research to understand about colour forecasting. And possibly like one of the most interesting aspects of it when I got to the economic was to look at the colours that we were surrounding ourselves with before the economic crash of 2008. And you can quite clearly see that there's quite high chromacity, there's a lot of vibrancy, a lot of colour blocking. And then you look at the same seasons in interiors and fashion, and this is the way that it's presented. Obviously, you can find all the colours all the time, wherever, but it's the narrative, as you said, Judith. And you see that all those colours were there. However, the chromacity had been dialed down. There was a lot more muted versions of these colours. And then the proportionality was very interesting as well, because whereas it was the large scale items that had the vibrancy of colour, they were the ones that obviously went to the muted tones. But you still had this vibrancy popping out through smaller pieces, accent pieces, particularly in the interiors realm or within fashion as kind of accessories or embellishments. So I think that that's like a really interesting relationship. When we're looking for a particular project for a client, we're looking at several aspects. We're looking at the colour psychology of it. We do look at colour symbolism as well, because obviously culturally around the world, our references to colour are slightly different. We look at the ergonomics of colour as well. So how inclusive it is, how you can understand shape and form through colour. And also emerging sciences are incredibly important. I'm absolutely fascinated by biotechnology and particularly how it will impact the colour industry. And this is something that, you know, will affect how we choose colour. And it also gives us the opportunity to educate how consumers look at colour as well. So there are all of these realms that are within our methodology of how we're addressing colour. Very importantly as well is who's the colour for. So in terms of brand definition, all of our colours are always then adapted so that they resonate with the brand that we're working for.
There's a lot of things to take into account indeed when choosing the right colour and doing colour trends for whoever you are working with. But you touch up on a very interesting point about those colors being more muted after the economical crisis a couple of years ago. Do you feel we're going to go into that direction as well with this current crisis that we all living, the pandemic?
I think that they're going to go in two aspects, actually. I think that we are looking at products that have more meaning and that feel less harmful to the environment, because let's not forget that we've got the pandemic that's happening, but behind it is this existential crisis of climate change. And I think people naturally associate the more natural coloured tones as being more environmentally friendly. Whether that's a fact or not is dependent on what the product is. But you can see it already with some of the colour of the years that were announced for 2021. It's interesting to see a very similar colour space has been announced for many brands, but you can see the cultural associations change through the territories, which I think is very interesting. And I think that we will see that when we start seeing new products coming out in the next year or so, as people kind of get over this. For every trend, though, there's a counter trend, isn't there? So whereas some people will be feeling that they need this kind of peace and quietness, a place of kind of restoration, there are going to be other people who are looking to party big time and are looking to spend money. I think that's something that the pandemic has shown, the difference between people's jobs. Whereas some people have thrived in the pandemic, they've saved money, so economically they're more secure than ever. Many people have lost virtually everything. And so I think that will come across it in how consumer spending manifests itself.
That's a very sad, but I think a very important point that a lot of people tend to forget, because I do think that we're going to come out of this. For some, they're going to come out of this better, and some obviously, just like you said, they've lost everything. And I do think that this duality is going to be even more key moving forward in colour, but in generally in any way that we are actually living our lives. From a very early time in your career, you also were passionate about architecture. Currently, you are focusing on urban planning and how colour can improve our lives in cities. Can you explain a little bit about this project and what this direction in your new work is all about?
Yeah, absolutely. I am daughter of an architect, and so I've grown up in that world. I was lucky enough to grow up in a house that he designed, and he had his own business, so he was always very open about the process. He was always very encouraging, and he was the one who possibly gave me my first insights into applied colour psychology, although perhaps I didn't realise it at the time. But he offered me a little bit of work just out of college to help him with a mental health facility, which was an incredible project. Obviously, a lot of the materials within the spaces have to be secure because people would tend to self-harm or be violent. There was one factor, actually, with all of the patients that were in this facility, was that they had various issues, but everybody was deaf. And I think I kind of focused in on that and really kind of drilled down into colour and what you could do with colour. And there wasn't a lot of information at the time. But that fascination with how colour influences us in spaces has, you know, it's always bubbled away in the background. And Carolina and I do a lot of work around the East End of London, particularly around Tech City in Old Street. And it's a place of phenomenal construction, like huge amounts of construction, a lot of it residential, but it's all very thin, tall skyscrapers. There seems to be a trend within architecture for narrow, vertigo-inducing structures. And a lot of these buildings are just grey. But I say just grey, they're not just grey. They have various undertones to them. And looking at them, they're very imposing. They feel like they're kind of pressing down on you. But the tones of grey don't even harmonise with each other. And so this kind of started this process of starting to look at architecture and the lack of planning. So for the last couple of years, we've been engaging with architects and trying to understand their world, to understand the issues that they have. And a lot of it comes from a lack of education within the planning departments, or developers just trying to make the biggest profit margin. But there's so much more that we can do with colour in terms of supporting the people within the cities. And ever more so now, as people are moving out of the cities, I think London lost about 400,000 over the last year, as people have looked for cheaper housing, better quality living. How do we make our city somewhere that people want to be again? And so this is something that we've started exploring in terms of how colour can really help the cities. At the moment, when you talk to architects or developers and you talk about colour, they talk about this overt colourfulness. And it seems to be these extremes. It's either colourful or colourless. And what we're looking for as human beings is variety, is rhythm and appropriate colour as well. You know, there are times when you want vibrancy of colour, you want that excitement, you want that experience, but you don't want to live in that all of the time. And at the same time, when we live in places that are monochromatic, they're very demotivating, they sap your energy. So we need to have that variety, and logically, it needs to be done in the planning.
So from the early start, when, you know, architects have an idea of when they are coming into a project, to think immediately about the community and what that particular community is requesting. So also how color can have a social impact. I understand you totally with, you know, the 50 shades of gray, obviously, of, you know, cities such as London. Me, luckily living in Italy, we obviously have more of those Mediterranean colors. But we do see that popping up here in Milan as well. So this is definitely something that is the future, because we have the same here. We have a lot of people that are moving out of the city, buying, you know, homes in the countryside. So they are more connected with nature and indeed paying a lot less. So I do think that color-wise and planning-wise, it's not just London, it's just worldwide. Things have to change. And I think during COVID-19, that change can finally come along with everything that we are doing.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you. When you look at cities of the world, a lot of our issues are very similar. And there's a lot that you can do with colour that can mitigate some of these issues. Colour is not going to solve any of your mental health problems. It is not going to put more money in your pocket. It can give you a platform where you feel a renewed sense of optimism that helps sort some of these issues out. Mm. And I think it's a really interesting place to explore. From the architects that we've talked to, from very large firms, we found out that actually a lot of the big global projects do actually come through London. And the architects themselves are very concerned, they're very considered in what they're doing. But then the issue is they're looking after what they're doing. The architect next to them is looking after what they're doing. But nobody seems to be looking at the bigger plan, at the greater scheme of things. And it seems as though the conversations within the planning departments are about replicating existing colour, which doesn't really talk about a future narrative or a growth path or personal taste quite often. And these are really difficult issues to combat.
Yeah, but yeah, luckily you are talking to all these architects and knowing that most projects actually go through London, that also gives hope for the rest of Europe, of course. So is this why your new project that's called Contactless Playground, that indeed talks about color in the urban space and how, as you said in your research, that some cities are indeed becoming more, let's say, hostile towards children as well. Is that your inspiration through urban planning, how you got to this particular concept together with Carolina? Can you talk a little bit more about this project?
The Contactless Playground comes from a TV news piece, actually, where the newscaster was interviewing a single mother. She had two children. One was 7 years of age and one was about 7 months. Now, this mother, she lived in what we call temporary accommodation. The reality is that a lot of people living in this temporary accommodation could be there for years. At the moment, there are 127,000 children in the UK living in this type of temporary accommodation. And when I say temporary accommodation, there have been changes to planning rules that allow developers to change the use of, say, an office building without having planning permission to do it. They don't need to. Now, these are not always adapted to the needs of residents. They have a lot of social issues within them, a lot of drugs, a lot of alcohol. These are the better versions. They're also using shipping containers. Now, you know, this is,
oh, wow.
This is kind of, they call it short-term accommodation, but, you know, the amount of people that have been there for over 2 years. Now, what had happened to this woman, what she was explaining was that at the first lockdown, I don't know how it happened in Italy, but in the UK, they also closed all of the playgrounds. So all the playground equipment was covered over.
Yeah, they did the same here.
Yeah, and it was tragic. I think that was kind of one of the most poignant moments, is seeing the playgrounds covered over and the kids locked out and trying to explain to them. We're lucky, we're unusual within London that we've got quite a big garden. So my kids were fine. But this woman, the only place that she could take her children was the local bus station to have a run around. And that just, it kind of beggars belief, just that these are your only options. So that kind of set off this like chain of thinking of, okay, so what could you do in a contactless environment to engage with children, to give them something that could be deployed to these areas? So it would have to be something that was modular, something that was economic, budget-wise, because people aren't going to be spending a lot of money on these things. And how can we get children active? And they show that outdoor play, it's not just a process of playing, but there's a process of learning and understanding that you need all these elements of risk, creativity, challenge within play environments. So we interviewed a lot of childcare practitioners to understand how children play. I enlisted the help of my five-year-old in terms of exploring some of the areas. But we didn't want it to just be for little children, because again, I think there's a sector of youth that is ignored out of these kind of play schemes. So that was a real driver in the solid colours that we chose, as they're the ones that are specifically designed towards older kids, encouraging them to feel included in it and to be playful. So the playground uses light, natural daylight, and coloured translucent materials to create shadow play. Low-level spinners on the ground that don't need any activity in terms of like holding on to bars or anything like that. Employing things like dichroic mirror surfaces, so kids have got the opportunity to do like funny face pulling and just be ridiculous. And then finally looking at how you use RGB lighting and how you could perhaps bring that into the outside world. I'd seen the way that my kids had played at exhibitions, and they love an installation where they can jump about. And this is all aspects that will get them moving and lift their spirits. And that is the whole point of it, is allowing them to have some freedom, but within an environment where there's little or no kind of chance of transference of virus. This is why it's also like an open shape as well.
I think it would even be amazingly creative for adults to be playing in this. I mean, even when we go to museums, or, you know, when we were still allowed to go to museums and to exhibitions, I mean, we even would play with all those, you know, different types of lighting, and then you've got Instagrammability of certain exhibitions. I mean, the focus obviously is children, especially in larger cities, but I think it is really about community building and creating that connection again with whoever is living in the area, and how color can have an amazing social impact on community, including the children, of course.
Yeah. I mean, as we went back to the amount of greyness, or I don't know about in Milan, but here, a lot of the social housing, they seem to slap a bit of cheerful colour on the outside, thinking that that's going to speak about community. But it doesn't. You know, community is about people. And so just using colour for colour's sake is meaningless. You need to understand the community that you're building for when you're looking at those kinds of areas. Making everybody feel included is really important. And that's the approach that we would look to in terms of bringing more colour in. And the colours, in terms of the translucent colours for the playground, again, they're done really specifically. They're not done as the primaries. They're nuances that encourage that friendliness and elevate the feeling of warmth within them as well. So that was kind of a really important aspect to get across, that not all colours make you feel the same way.
That's very true. And I think also using the correct colour harmonisation and indeed creating that palette that works. It's not indeed just like you said, just slapping a colour on a wall and, you know, making a community or a neighbourhood more colourful in this way, especially if it's not well thought through and there's absolutely no narrative. And this is exactly why, you know, I think we both work in colour. We work with people, with companies, with brands, with organizations to make sure that they do not make these type of mistakes.
Absolutely. There is so much that goes into the colour for a brand or the colour for a new product launch. And again, I think how these colours are chosen and how they're presented, this is all going to develop. And, you know, it's up to us in a way as a colour industry to be leading that, to be progressing our clients in terms of making more sustainable and more considered and more meaningful, purposeful choices in the colours that they're putting forward.
Exactly. You clearly have used your lockdown very consciously and very well. You've definitely had more creativity going on, perhaps because, you know, finally we all had the time to literally observe our direct environment and how indeed your city in this particular case is influenced by this crisis, looking also at how your five-year-old daughter was reacting to her changing environment. What do you think is next for all of us trend-wise, and where do you think we're moving post-pandemic according to your observation? So not necessarily color-wise, but just really trend-wise, where are we going?
I think that there are going to be more movements. I'm sure I've used the word a lot, meaningful and purposeful. This is not a time, an opportunity for us to redefine how we want the world to look. And a lot of people are seeing things from new perspectives. They're understanding their world in a different way. They look at their environment in a different way. And they engage with the brands in a different way as well. I mean, one of the big physical changes that we're going to see is obviously in retail. Most retailers obviously gone online. Huge swathes of our high streets are disappearing. Probably one of the most iconic on London's streets and across the world would be somebody like Topshop that mm-hmm. will go completely online. So how does that present colour when you're seeing it online? So I think that's going to be a really interesting narrative. As we touched on about cities, I'm a little bit obsessed with cities at the moment and how these will change. I'm interested when you hear things about that Japanese app that kind of rates your local area and will give you the best places to be away from kids. Do our cities become more segregated? Is that how we're going to move forward? I think those kind of like big shifts in understanding what it is that we want and how we manifest that is going to be a really interesting change. I mentioned already that I absolutely love biotechnology. And I think it's really interesting that quite a few of the experimental processes that have been going on over the years in the next year or so are actually going to be taken to scale. I think that's going to be a phenomenal impact on the way that we produce product. I do see that we're going to be doing a lot more like collectibles. It's time that we don't use colour to just drive sales and that we use colour more to drive responsible buying behaviour. And I think we've got these real kind of opportunities here. I hope a lot of retailers and brands take on. I saw a very interesting talk this week and they had on retail innovation head from Vans. And he was talking about, you know, the way that they kind of build up other businesses and create these communities and that interest in localism as well and how you democratize these like huge corporations and make them more autonomous. So I think all of those aspects are going to be really interesting. I mean, it's one of the points that we touch on in our Colour Manifesto is about identity. And obviously over the last couple of years, we've seen that feeling of identity taken to the extreme where you have people becoming nationalists more. Mm-hmm. But that importance of identity is still there and having control over your own destiny. And it's kind of like an anti-globalization, anti-homogenization and having those unique experiences, which I think is all really good, local, sustainable stuff.
So yeah, it sounds like there's going to be a lot of personalization even more because that's not always been a new trend, but you do see that, you know, when you talk about identity, obviously you have your own proper identity as a person, as a brand, as a company, as a retailer. So that's going to be very key over the next years moving forward, because I do think that COVID-19 has accelerated everything that's been happening. So possibly the trends that we saw already last year, especially technology-wise, they have been accelerated because simply they must, especially now with everything online and color online. We still obviously have some issues there because, you know, one screen is not the same as the other screen. But especially, I think the topic on how color can impact the environment and also how it can impact indeed products and not buying all that stuff that we have been buying, at least pre-COVID. I mean, we're all, you know, wearing the same pair of shoes now, if we're even wearing shoes. So, you know, we've really come to understand that we don't need all of that. And that I completely agree with you, that will change over the next couple of years. And it has to change.
Exactly. And you know, in terms of the rental market, where, you know, we're not just renting our homes, but we're renting our wardrobes, we're renting cars, we're renting everything. All of this, colour needs to take that on board. And you need to look at colour in a different way. It needs to have more longevity. I talk to people in the fashion industry and obviously they're talking about their seasonality, which from interiors and product design, we don't struggle with as much as they do. However, they're identifying that a lot of this is just a nonsense, and you don't need to have two seasons plus all your capsule collections. This is excessive. And how do you design products that people want to love, people want to be in, and extend their life cycle, you know, obviously, like, close both ends.
I think color longevity is an interesting topic that you talked about. I think that is very key for a lot of markets moving forward, including fashion, and especially fast moving fashion. Justine, one last question. Is there maybe a project that you're starting to work on currently that you'd like the audience already to know about, or maybe something that else that you want to highlight on that's next for you and Carolina with Kazada Fox?
We're talking to a lot of brands about changing cultures within the business on how they look at color, which is a really positive move from the brands, because I think as much as we focus on color and talk about color, there's still a real disconnect through businesses about this brand value of color. And I think those are going to be, like, really interesting. I'm quite excited about that. And as much as I, you know, talk about trend as not being my personal key focus, we do still have a lot of trend stuff. And what's really nice is that the trend work that we work on, these are with clients who are very engaged in having much more specific color focused materials, rather than it being kind of a general global, you know, very vague. They're much more interested in being much more specific now, which I think is a really positive move forward in the trend industry in general.
Yeah, I do think that we are, just like you said earlier in the conversation, you know, there's more, let's say, nationalism. People are focusing on their own proper communities, their own countries, their direct living conditions. So I do think that this whole global trend work is still of interest, but then you possibly have to tap that down into regional or even local trends that we are all seeing happening currently, because our vision is a little bit smaller currently. So that's an interesting thing that's going to be happening over the next couple of weeks. So I'm excited for you and for Carolina. It looks like you have a lot of new interesting projects and things that you are moving on forward for the near future. And I personally really, really want to thank you for this talk. It's been inspiring for me, and I'm sure that it's also been very inspiring for our listeners. And thank you so much, Justine.
You're welcome. It's been lovely to chat. Thanks so much for having us.